I'm Jerry Swanson, here from Thousand Oaks, and Jody asked me if I would moderate tonight's forum. And in thinking about it and talking about it, his initial idea was a chance for folks to come together and to share experiences in the form of story, of multicultural ministry that works. And that seems to me to be a good thing for us to be about at this part of the rainbow journey, to have an offering of stories. And as I was thinking about coming together, I was reminded of what I'm sure is a Mennonite tradition, and I think there are many other traditions that have it too, and that is to think about this as really a time of sharing testimonies. I've thought about the two books that Doris Longacre Jansen put together, the cookbook More with Less, and then there's another one that's kind of simple living ideas, More with Less. So I thought that this could be a time of sharing stories of more rainbow and less gray. That isn't meant to be a slam at any of us who are on our way to that. I mean, those of us who are gray, it's a vibrant gray.
The gray of America.
Right. But I'm just thinking of a gray kind of sodden thing that churches can look like. So this is a chance to celebrate more rainbow. I have no predetermined arrangement of how the stories might unfold. I would like simply for us to be sensitive to one another and the chances to have stories touch each other and interact. So that kind of an openness, and at 10 o'clock, in spite of the fact that we're starting at 9:08, we will call a halt to get in on the shower. There is one, I'd like to kick things off, because there's been a very good connection for me this week in being here. And it goes with James Harris being here from Detroit. 20 years ago, I was an associate pastor at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Detroit on the East Side, a church that was really in the first stages of responding to a changing community, responding to the fact that one of Detroit's largest public housing projects was just across the street in the park from the church. And what we were doing 20 years ago now seems to have been a lot of seeding. We had found a document from the Mary Knoll missionaries that they were using in Latin America, which called for them to be tuned in to all of the agencies and the groups in their communities that were working for good, and to seek friendships and alliances with those groups, and for their pastoral work to still be very much with the sacraments and with the proclamation of the gospel, but to share resources, share energy. So we were trying to be faithful to that, and that led us to be a part of Head Start programs and daycare in the projects. It led us to join forces with the New Detroit Committee in some ways that we could, and for providing space for the ADC mothers to meet in our church, and even to join forces with the Black Panthers in the East Side, who were about providing hot breakfast for the children in the area. And that's been a model of ministry that has been very positive for me. Now I come here, and 20 years later, James Harris is the minister of music in that congregation. And James, if you wouldn't mind just picking up a little bit and speaking out of Detroit. Janet is here from Detroit, and Joe is here. We've kind of got Detroit, we've got Southern California, we've got Oakland, the Northwest, and wherever else people bring experiences from.
Well, I've been at Emmanuel now for 3 years, coming from Hope Church before I went to Emmanuel. Emmanuel, if I can share just a little history of it, Emmanuel is a congregation that's very wealthy. If you've ever heard of Grosse Pointe is an elite area of Detroit where Henry Ford lived. Well, I would say possibly one third of the membership of Emmanuel lives in Grosse Pointe, but they commute to Emmanuel, which is about 4 or 5 miles. I guess when the neighborhood started changing about 20 years ago, there was a major decision that had to be made by the congregation whether or not they wanted to remain in that neighborhood. And under the leadership of a pastor by the name of Pastor Truitt, he was able to convince the majority of the people that the church should not run or flee from a changing neighborhood, but to provide ministry to the people in that neighborhood, no matter the color. And so thus remained a very beautiful facility with the gymnasium and just well kept, very clean. Down through the years, they've kept the building up. The neighborhood is completely changed now to where it's about 99% black. The membership in the congregation right now is still holding on very strong, and the church is doing a lot of neighborhood type of social ministry along with the basic ministry of ministering to the members of the congregation. I was the first black person employed there full time. They did have an intern there that was there for a short period of time, Cynthia Schuler, who was a past pastor in Detroit at the time. And the dynamics of going into a congregation that had never witnessed a black person in a leadership role for a long period of time was interesting the first year. And now we are going along very well. We have developed a very active music program with the Bell Choir, Children's Choir, Bell Choir, about 5 ensembles. And we are very active also with the Metropolitan Detroit Coalition, which is a coalition of parishes in the city of Detroit that works to provide support to pastors, because the majority, actually all of the pastors in Detroit, Lutheran pastors, are still all white, which is something that has to be addressed down the road as time goes on. And our assistant bishop, assistant to the bishop,
that's my name. It's supposed to change all that.
But I guess I want to share with you that initially it can be rather tough on both sides when you have influx of different race into a congregation. I witnessed it at Emmanuel, because we were the first heavy influx of blacks into that congregation. And there was a structure.
It happened because another church had
to close. Tell them how.
I mean, that's it. I know you don't want the negatives, but.
Yeah, tell them how many of you came when you came.
Yeah, there were about 20 who came into the church because another church closed. And we had a structured approach to integrate, to mix, and to become a part of the congregation. And fortunately, it has worked. People have been very supportive, and they had a shepherding program where each member of the congregation is assigned to a shepherd. And that shepherd became sort of like a class or a group, and we met and got to know each other, and we worked and supported each other. So during the past 3 years, the music program has provided a glue to keep people involved. We have a our choir is about 50-50 in makeup racially, and we enjoy singing. It was different because initially the congregation had not had spirituals, even gospel music sung in the church before. They had only had Bach and the more classical music, so it was kind of a big change for them. When I did do a gospel number one time, and now it's to the point where everybody is accepting of all types of music over a period of time that has come about. So,
thanks. Anybody feel inclined to pick up?
I wanted to ask one more question about the story. When you said that a large group of people came into the congregation, had you all been from a Lutheran tradition in the past?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There was another Lutheran church that closed.
Okay. Well, you said a church closed, but I didn't know if it was open.
Yeah. Now there's a major drive on the part of the congregation to get involved in a stronger way with community to get people into the church, because up until now it was considered basically the little white church that was there, but never really feeling that, well, we belong, or that we are welcome in that church. Now there's been a change where there's an openness now to anyone. And during the past 2 years or so, I would guess 15, 20 new families from the neighborhood have become members of the church. I should also tell you that the average age of the white membership right now is about 60. And they make up about 85% of the congregation at this time. So, you know, we all see the handwriting on the wall 10, 15 years from now. Mm-hmm. So.
I'd like to pick up the story, but from a different cultural tradition. I've had experience working in Native American and Anglo congregation, and a Hispanic Anglo congregation. And the Hispanic Anglo congregation happened in Los Angeles, in Southeast Los Angeles, a place that when I arrived in 1979, the community had become about 80 to 90% Hispanic. The church, Maywood United Methodist Church, had chosen to again stay in the neighborhood and to begin a ministry among Hispanics, recognizing the difficulty of both language as well as culturally most Hispanics are Roman Catholic. But they hired a part-time Spanish-speaking pastor. And when I arrived in 1979, the year before, they had just employed a Spanish, a bilingual pastor who was to be the head pastor of both the fledgling Hispanic-speaking congregation as well as the Anglo congregation. So when I arrived, the Anglos now had their first time bilingual pastor. When I arrived, my work became to work with the aging Anglo white congregation. And I would say, James, our average age was probably 70, and 90% of them were women in polyester dresses. When I first arrived, there was about 100 that all looked the same to me. But one of the strategies, and probably the most useful strategy that we developed, was that in order to birth the new congregation, it was important to keep the other congregation as strong as possible. Because one of the things that had happened in many Hispanic situations was, as the Anglo congregation receded, then so did care of the property. And by the time the Spanish congregation was able to take over, they were left with a decaying building that hadn't been kept up. And they were at such a struggling place that they were both struggling in terms of numbers and finances to make it, and they were left with a building that had been neglected. So our clear strategy was the Anglos were the primary economic supporters, but their mission was to keep the building and the mission strong until the Hispanics were able to take that over. At the same time, doing a number of things to increase communication between essentially two different worshiping congregations, mostly because of language. We had a 10 o'clock English service and then a 11:30 Spanish service. And when David and I started working together, about quarterly we would have joint services, and the bulletin would be both in Spanish and English, and David and I would go back and forth in Spanish and English, and we'd sing in both languages, and we'd pray sometimes in both languages. It took us an immense time to put together the first bilingual service and then to adapt it so that the Anglos could understand what was going on and the Spanish could participate and feel comfortable as well. And that was a fruitful 3 years, and I would say the 3 years that David and I worked together, I learned how to speak Spanish to a limited degree. And we kept the Anglo congregation strong and supportive, and the Spanish congregation grew. The problem came after I left, and then David left the year afterwards, and I would say things are more difficult maintaining that, but that has to do with changing the pastoral leadership, changing financial resources. Some of the strong Anglo leaders either died or got burglarized too many times and left the community, and the Spanish congregation was also still struggling. But at least the strategy while we were there together, I think, was one of the better models for working together in a bicultural situation.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. Yeah.
Do I understand you to say that you did have really two separate congregations?
Separate in terms of program and worship. There, as part of the main church budget, there was a Spanish department of the budget. But there was part of that Spanish department budget went to support the full-time pastorate of the bilingual pastor. My salary was largely picked up by the Anglo part of the congregation, but David's salary was split between the two.
My reason for asking is, in St. Paul, Minneapolis, or Minnesota, we have the second largest concentration of Hmong people. Mm. And in our metro area, one man was doing mission work, so to speak, amongst the Hmong in Minneapolis, and somehow another group got started in St. Paul. And they both had connections with the Missouri Synod, the district, and all that. And they wanted to bring these two together, and that's how we at Jehovah, in the midway between the two cities, we've become landlords to the Hmong congregation. And I'm pleased to hear your story, because I've been dismayed that these Hmong are really going to be fine German Lutheran Missouri Synod types, except they'll be speaking Hmong. Mm-hmm. Right now, they are asking us to respect their culture and their ways, and we're searching for bridges between the two congregations. They are hospitable and invite the Caucasian congregation to their New Year's festivals, and we've had a bilingual service. But I really would like to see more things happen together, but it looks like that'll be a little while. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting you mentioned that. I just have to share one of, this is not the story I want to share, but there's a congregation in Detroit called St. Andrew the Redeemer, which is a merger of several congregations, and their predominant group is Black and Hmong at this point, and that is a fascinating to watch. And I was there for their Easter vigil, and James knows that they also have an immersion tub, and I watched these Hmong people watch while a Black adolescent was being baptized in the. I thought, I wonder what those people are thinking in terms of their own experience. And then back again a few weeks ago, and the gospel then was being read in Hmong and in English, and so they were working on bridging those gaps, and it seems to be working, and it's just sort of, you sort of watch and think, you know, the Spirit is here. That's all you can say.
I think you should also say that St. Andrew Redeemer has got this baptism where people can be, and any of the Lutheran churches that have people who don't want to be sprinkled and actually want to go under can go to St. Andrew the Redeemer and get baptized. And go, it's
I thought I had seen everything. So I walked in there that night. And I had to go through this thing. If it doesn't say how much water.
Very good.
There is in St. Paul another model for ministry with Southeast Asians. It's Christ Lutheran Church, and they're mainlining everything, and they read the gospel in at least two languages every Sunday, and the consecration is done in three.
That's great. Hmm.
What's the third?
That's real.
Khmer Rouge or one of the other Southeast
Cambodian.
Cambodian, that's it. Mm-hmm. Cambodian, Hmong, and English.
Hmm. Thank you. Barry?
Yeah, I was just, I mean, my experience sort of takes off from all of this stuff, too. I worked on the staff of an Episcopal church in inner city Boston, one of four denominations that I've now worked for. But anyway, I've always remained a member of the Church of Christ, but I worked for. Anyway, and a church that is just about a third Black, a third Puerto Rican, and a third white, with even a couple Chinese families, in a neighborhood that is has got, well, I won't go through its whole history, but it's a neighborhood that has been for some time having some of the more infamous housing projects, and it's certainly one of the lower income neighborhoods, and now is one of the models in the country for gentrification. So it's a place where the neighborhood's changing, but just the opposite from what was happening in 20 years ago, and it's probably happening in a lot of other places too. But it's a very poor church for the most part, very small church. But the service, there is no separate congregation. The service is completely bilingual. The sermon is done every week completely in English and completely in Spanish. The liturgy is not read orally in both languages, but the church has put together its own version of the Episcopal liturgy, which has the Spanish on one page and the English on one page. And so parts are read in Spanish and part in English, but then you can follow in the other language. What's interesting about it is we sort of used to have a joke about it. It's a sort of a chaotic high church Episcopal. Some of the actual liturgy is quite high church, but the service is just chaos in terms of, it isn't if you're used to it, but some people just couldn't handle it. They would come and visit. I mean, kids are running up and down the aisles all the time, and things never go right. I mean, it's never done smoothly. But you learn, I had one of the most enriching experiences ever in learning to come to a place where I could accept that. There is probably more of a need, since the Puerto Rican community is the newest of the ethnic groups in the church. There's a more of a need and a respect for the fact that they do meet more separately in some occasions than other people in the church. There really isn't as much of, say, a Black or a white caucus or special programs, whereas there is for Puerto Rican, and there were the staff included white, Black, and Hispanic. And there ordinance for that. Obviously, we could all talk a lot about all the different aspects of it. We certainly had our problems, and there were certainly tensions and things, but they always seemed to work out. I would say that just in terms of, you know, what allowed that kind of place to happen and to continue, I think some of it certainly had to do with a man who was the priest there for 18 years. The church was a mission of the diocese originally, and had originally, in many ways, ministered primarily to Cuban a community of Cubans that had been there in the early 60s and now had mostly left the neighborhood. But out of that, it took on a bilingual nature, and then it was through this one man, Bill Dwyer, who is, this is another lesson I learned. I learned as much from him about ministry and community organizing as anyone, and yet when you first meet him, he's the spaciest, most disorganized man I've ever met in my entire life. And yet he got stuff done. And a lot of it was because he had an incredible sense of caring about people, but not just sort of in a sentimental way. He really understood the structures in the neighborhood, and he was willing to address those. And he also, he obviously spoke fluent Spanish, and there was a real trust that he built in that neighborhood without having to sort of barge his way in. He was really, there was a real effort in the church. He had a real sense of leadership, but at the same time was willing to back off and really let people in the church try to run the church. The second thing is that I think maybe even more importantly, that the church was known as being an integral part of the neighborhood in its justice work, and all connected in coalitions with a lot of agencies and organizations that were not church related. And I think that probably as much as anything else, that the ministry of the church was seen, the evangelism, quote unquote, of the church was working for social change and justice in that neighborhood. And that's what really, I think, cemented a sense of the cohesion and the attractiveness of people in that neighborhood to there. I mean, in a very poor church, I was paid to do community organizing, and as well as a lot of work with youth, and worked on housing issues primarily in coalition building as a major part of my job. And that was a commitment that they made, and we also had a lot of ministry to transient people and homeless and all those kind of stuff. But it wasn't just to direct service stuff. It was very much seen as a church who was an integral part of building two major mixed income housing projects, and which are now models again for the nation. Anyway.
Thanks, Jen. Yeah.
I belong to Victory in Detroit, and in the late 50s and 60s they had a membership of almost 1,000 people at one time. And then the neighborhood made a transition. I'd like to clarify also, James's neighborhood changed from white to black, but it's a very well upper class middle neighborhood. It's not a neighborhood has changed in, how would you say?
Economically.
These are still middle class, upper middle class blacks that are moving in. The neighborhoods have boulevards, well-kept brick homes, okay? So I want you to know it's a very well-kept neighborhood.
That's helpful.
Okay, and so is the neighborhood that I live in. The people that were made the flight from the church made their flight, and the church continued going on. Our congregation is made up now, I would guess, maybe 50-50?
It looks like it.
Yeah. And the whites that we have in the church, and also the blacks that we have in the church, are very active. When we say we've got 110 on the book, and we've got about that many coming to church every Sunday. Okay.
Yeah.
And everybody does what they can. In other words, everybody works. Our seniors there's something that they can do and they all participate. We have been doing building sharing or church sharing for over 10 years. And what we do is we have our services at 10:30, and then we rent the building out. Well, we have rented it out to Baptist Church. We've rented it out to a Church of God in Christ Church. We've rented it out to Methodist Church, who just moved out last month, and now we're looking to rent it out to another one. And it worked out great because we had our services at 10 and they'd have their services at 12 o'clock. And the building was there, so why not utilize it? We also have what do we call the churches that help us, that are mission partner?
Yeah, we
have mission partner churches, and when Detroit won the baseball, what's it called?
World Series.
Well, we had had a potluck supper with a suburban church, which is out in Farmington Hills. It's like, you know, bloody dog, but out. And we had a potluck at our church. And it just happened to be the last day of the World Series. And we all brought our TV. Nobody wanted to miss the game. So it wasn't really planned. We brought the TVs and we had the potluck. And the fellowship that we shared between the church was just really fantastic. And last year we did a sharing with the our mission partner church where we exchanged choirs and we took our gospel music to their church. And it really was a really exciting experience because they had not really used to the kind of music. Our church is low on young people, and we've been without a pastor for a year, and we just called our first female pastor, and she'll be installed in September, so hopefully we'll be able to build our membership up. But what's neat about our church is, with or without a pastor, the lay leadership is so fantastic. The planning of services are unreal. We knew that we were trying to reach the neighborhood, so we wrote our own victory folk liturgy. We worked on it for over a year. Our folk liturgy has soon and very soon, and I got the spirit, I feel the spirit. In other words, we used the traditional type liturgy for our guidelines, but we gave it the music of the neighborhood. We intentionally, the worship committee intentionally set out to use gospel music, to be 50% gospel music, 50% anthem, so that we're using both cultures. Our white membership did not fight the changes. Sometimes they complain that the music is a little loud, but they still, but they still can say when they enjoy the music and when they don't enjoy the music. And everybody's needs are respected. We try to meet their needs.
Well, it sounds like Detroit's becoming a hotbed of liturgy and music.
Yeah. Thanks, Jenna. Please.
Yeah, I want to share my story of the church that I was at prior to the one I'm at now. And it was a small church in Hollywood, in the east part of Hollywood. When I arrived, it was a small Anglo culture congregation. I'll refer to it as English speaking because there was a diversity of skin color, but the culture itself was primarily Anglo in the way that congregation operated, of about 50 people. And there was a Korean Methodist church that rented the facility from us. Now we were two different denominations, we were both Methodists, but we were United Methodists and they were Korean Methodists. We were accountable to different bishops. Theirs was in Korea. And there came a point when they were trying to incorporate within the state of California as their own entity. And we began at that point to discuss our visions of the church, the pastor, the Korean pastor and I, and came to the conclusion that what we really felt was appropriate for the church was for us to be one congregation. And for them, since they were ultimately seeking to become United Methodists and become a recognized congregation in our denomination, that the easiest route for them, in fact, would be, rather than jumping through all the hoops that we have set up for establishing a new church, would be to join with us. So So we worked about a year on writing a covenant that we could all agree on and work together on. And we studied models from other churches around to make that decision about how we would do that. Ultimately, we became clear that we were each going to have to have responsibility for the facilities. And so our board of trustees became half and half. Half Korean and half English-speaking membership. And then we established what we call the KEE Committee, K-E for Korean and English. And that committee was to take care of the, after the covenant was signed, to take care of the ongoing communication needs, to do programming that would help us better understand one another and to respond to needs as they emerge. We also established a committee which was basically the heads of all of our committees and empowered them in an emergency to make a decision quickly so that it wouldn't have to go back and forth from each group. And get approved through, you know, that could take several months actually, and then come back again. So the decision needed to be made quickly. He empowered a group of people for a called meeting to make a decision and then disband. And those people were elected by office, not by name, so that when the office of treasurer, for example, changed, whoever the new treasurer was automatically a part of this committee. We really made a thing out of this, and we celebrated the signing of our covenant with a service, and we called in our district superintendent who preached. It was a separate service from the Sunday morning services. We had a separate service, and the signing and the coming forward to sign the covenant. And then we even had a cake. It was, the sermon, in fact, talked about how it was really a wedding of the two churches. And we each actually had a cake, and the Korean pastor and I cut the cake together. But we didn't feed each other. and we went through all the ceremony because we wanted to show ourselves and the world to make a statement of our commitment to this marriage and to this unity that we share. At first, the English-speaking membership said, well, this is the future of our church. We need to kind of get into this and let it happen. And it was, you know, because we need them, we will allow for this to happen. And as time went on, it became clear that we needed to do some things together with the youth. And so we planned a summer program with the youth, and we're doing this summer program, at the end of which the Koreans came to us, a group of them, sort of a delegation, and said, we don't understand our youth anymore. They're in your school. They speak a different language now. They speak English and then some. They don't remember their Korean, although they did have Korean culture classes for their youth and children every Sunday to maintain some of that. They said, the culture is different, we don't understand what they're doing or why they're doing, and we know that the future of our church is in them, and you understand them better than we do because the culture that they're now assimilating is yours. Will you work with our youth? We need you. Which was a real affirmation, for our congregation. They were, you know, that the English members were able to sit up a little straighter. The youth began to attend the English language worship service, and some of their parents came too. And that was exciting. That was exciting, and that's continuing somewhat. The other thing was worship. That we didn't worship together weekly, but we made clear that special celebrations were to be shared, and we always had. Thanksgiving Sunday, the Sunday before Thanksgiving, we had a celebration together at that time, a worship celebration. And our choirs joined together and learned music together and practiced music together for that. And afterwards, the Koreans made a feast because they have a festival of the Harvest Moon, which falls and is basically equivalent to our Thanksgiving. So we had a big Korean feast every year at that time. And the Sunday before Christmas, again, we would celebrate together. Palm Sunday, we would celebrate together. Worldwide Communion Sunday, we would celebrate together. Our worship service was in both languages, but it was never a translation.
prayers that were printed in the United Methodist Church, we put together our own liturgy each week, so it's a little bit different. The prayers that were printed would be printed in both languages, but a pastoral prayer was given by one or the other of us at that time. Sermons were half length, but fully given, and they were separate messages, so that for those people who understood both languages, they were able to glean from both sermons, theoretically, as much as anyone gleans from a sermon on any given Sunday. And those who didn't had 7 minutes of time to pray and meditate and use that time in other ways in a worship context. Mm. The Korean congregation, a Korean membership, purchased hymnals that were printed both in English and in Korean. And when we worshiped together, those were the hymnals we used. So we could sing the same hymns in our own languages. Mm. And it was exciting. And I have not been at that church now for a little over a year, and my successor had been taking a year to kind of get a sense of the dynamics, and just within the last few months has called the English language membership again to accountability and saying, okay, we have done this, and now we're sitting back, and we need to start reaching out on a mission again. We can't just say this is what we've done and that's it. And they've rallied to that, and they're excited about that, and they're really working on visioning and reaching out some more in other ways, as well as maintaining that partnership, which goes on. Of course, there are struggles, as there is in any relationship and any marriage, but it's been excited to participate. One of the things that really helped that whole dynamic was that I was able to go to Korea and spend 3 weeks visiting churches in Korea. There was a study team being organized at that time, and I knew I couldn't afford to go, and the bishop said, this is important, and he put some money in there, I might go, to be able to go. And the church did too. I received money, gift money from the church, because it was important. And I think my being willing and able to go to Korea and learn about the church in Korea spoke very clearly and very loudly to the Korean members that this was a priority for us.
Yeah, great, thanks. Yeah, Marshall, I was hoping Oakland would be heard from.
Yeah, so I'll go to Bethlehem Lutheran Church, which is looked upon as being a black church, but I don't know, we're going to have to call it something else, I guess, because
it's 80-20. That's what they keep their percentage of.
Yeah.
But is that my replacement yet?
80-20, no. Well, she was a member of our church, still is a member. The pastor's not going to let her change her membership. Bible Solomon's a member of our church. We speak 27 different languages in our church. That first Sunday of Pentecost, you hear them all in Greek, Spanish, French, German, name it. We got Nigerians, Ethiopians, South Africans, Asians. Just about anything you want to throw the dart on the board, you probably find one of them at our church. We have Will Hirschfeld, which a lot of us know black, as the presiding pastor. We also have two other pastors that are all calling assistant. One's from South Africa and one's white. Bob's wife directs our choir, which is made up of black, white, South Africans. It's just a rainbow in itself right there. I think maybe we have to start calling it the Rainbow Church or something like that. But it's been really beautiful for me to be in attendance there, and I think that our pastor has a lot to do with that, and he spread his spirit down towards the congregation where we actually seek, if we don't have one, we try and find one. And to bring them into our membership so that we stay as rainbow as you can get. We have a couple special people in our congregation that has special needs we take care of. And we have poor, we have middle class, we have the wealthy. It's in West Oakland inside of a drug infested neighborhood, which is not the glory of it, but it's one of the most beautiful churches that I happen to be in attendance of. Bob probably should tell us a little bit more about the history of Bethlehem. He knows a little more than I do.
Yeah, it's a kind of curious history. It was originally a black congregation within the Missouri Synod. And that's not as unusual as it might sound in that Missouri Synod and some of its other conservative church bodies, Wisconsin Synod and something called the Synodical Conference, had a fair amount of black mission type churches in the South, and old school system for black pastors and that there. And Bethlehem itself developed as sort of the outreach of a black Missouri Synod Lutheran Church in New Orleans. Now, New Orleans is not real close to Oakland. However, the Southern Pacific Railroad had New Orleans at one end and Oakland at the other. And black porters in the railroad who were members of, I think it's also Bethlehem,
yeah, it's Bethlehem
in New Orleans, were some of the first blacks who, with stable incomes and that, to buy homes in West Oakland. And that's how the congregation started. And it was in a different facility for a while, but there was this well-established white German Lutheran church called, among other people, nurtured the what I like to call the missionary position of Ed Meese. He was a boy of the church. But when the neighborhood started changing black around the time of before and during the Second World War, that old church, Zion, moved up the hill into Piedmont, which is a rich community, totally surrounded by Oakland, which has a parasitical relationship to Oakland, and made some arrangement whereby Bethlehem, this church, this mission church from New Orleans, got what really is a wonderful old building. It's got the best acoustics of any room I've ever seen in my life. Unfortunately, they stripped it of a good organ and took it up the hill with them. But it struggled for a long time. Had a white pastor who was dying of cancer for a long time. And when Will Herzfeld, who had been in Oakland, but in a variety of roles, partially working for the, well, for a while working for the Missouri Synod as a co-urban minister, and for a while working for Lutheran Council USA, took it over, and a lot of it has to do with, I think, his remarkable ability to relate to all sorts of folk. Highly sophisticated blacks like Robert Maynard, who owns the Oakland Tribune and is often on McNeil Lehrer and this week with David Brinkley. Professional basketball players. He's a chaplain to the Golden State Warriors, although many of his closest people were recently traded to Houston.
There'll be a Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Houston.
Joe Barry Carroll, who was traded for Ralph Sampson, apparently called him right after the trade and said the rumor was that they were also going to trade for the chaplain in exchange for future consideration. It's also very much a regional church, although it does have people from the immediate community, and some who are poor from the community and some of whom own homes there for a long time. It also has members that are coming in from Vallejo, which is 20, 30 miles away, and San Jose and San Francisco and what have you. In the last year and a half or so, the music of the church has been a remarkable attraction. And if you were in an earlier thing, today I played some of the jazzy type of music that we're doing there, that people are coming to the church to sing in the choir. And we have enormous flexibility in music. Last month we did an entirely Bach service. We used the old red service book and hymnal, which has a lot of Bach harmonizations in it. Some of it was on vibraphone and some modern instruments, but it was basically a real classical Bach. And other times we're doing African music or jazzy, gospel, spirituals, and that sort of thing. I thought of recent people who have joined the church, it's probably been about 50% white each time that people have been joining. And part of it from other Lutheran congregations who found them to be dead in one way or another, and find it as a place of real activity. One other thing is it tries to reach out both in direct response to food needs and that sort of thing in the immediate community, but also the type of style of ministry that Will has has long been addressing Board of Education, city politics, county board of supervisors stuff, and it's also long had a very close interest, of course, in African issues, both with African members. It had a Namibian pastor there for a while as an associate, and it's a really exciting place, and if you're around Oakland, come visit.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. Jim, I wonder if...
Well,
I've got a few minutes here. You're getting socked with...
The ministry that I was under the impression to talk about is multicultural ministry to people who need ministry.
Uh-huh.
In the urban core of every city, there are thousands and thousands of homeless people. They're the people of whom I was thinking we were going to talk about. What works within the church as far as reaching out to those on the fringes?
Mm-hmm.
And this is something different that the Compass Center that I am the director of and have been there for the last 8 years is a type of ministry where the congregation is a multicultural congregation of between 3,000 and 4,000 people, all of them homeless, all of them earning between $0 to $300 a month, which is 314, which is the GAU or the welfare check.
Mm-hmm.
Women and men and alcoholic and mentally ill and the chronic suffering people of our culture. And 35-40% of them are black, another 7-8% of them are Hispanic, and 10% are Native American. And the rest are white. These are the homeless people that we find in downtown Seattle. The church has a building in the middle of this Skid Row area that owns this building, and it is the center for services for all of these people.
How did that get started?
1920.
Wow.
By a man by the name of Carl Strunk, a Swedish pastor. Has been there, not in this building, but has been in Skid Row to Pioneer Square in Seattle in 1920.
It's very un-Lutheran.
It's the most unique ministry that is within the Lutheran Church. The Lutheran Church has always stayed away from this kind of stuff and has left it up to the Salvation Army and the other Save the Soul type of missions.
Mm.
And this is what makes this particular place unique. And that it reaches out not only multiculturally, but with a multicultural staff, and it reaches out to the whole person, all five parts, emotional, social, physical, mental, and spiritual, so that the whole person is treated, and our emphasis and focus is for each individual person to be able to break the cycle of homelessness. Whether that person is a victim of domestic violence, whether that person is a chronic alcoholic person, whether the person is a heroin addict or a mentally ill person or whatever.
Mm.
And so we have many, many different services. Staff of 30 people, a budget of $760,000, and have a building that's worth probably $3 million. That's in downtown Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
I urge people who come through Seattle to stop and visit this place.
How was that $760,000 raised?
United Way,
uh-huh.
Constituency, and the internal revenue created by the agency. We have 84 shelter beds there that are temporary emergency home for people. It's not a shelter that empties out like all of the other shelters every day. But we have 16 shelter rooms for women, and 68 for men. We charge everybody $3 a night. So it's not a free shelter.
What if they don't have it?
We give them credit, And then we use vouchering systems with local congregations and agencies. We expect them to do something for themselves, and our counselors and social workers and case managers are trained to be able to get these people on public welfare within usually a period of a week. But that welfare money needs to be used for what it's meant, and they can stay there from 2 to 3 months. And then we go beyond that short period of permanent temporary housing to more long-term transitional homes. We have 5 homes in the suburban communities that are operated by the Compass Center. It's interesting that this is called the Compass. And if you go to the homeless people of Oakland, or San Francisco, or Los Angeles, or San Diego, or Portland, and if anybody of the homeless transient are moving to Seattle, and they're talking about where to go, the word is, go to the Compass. Mm. They don't call it Lutheran, and they don't call it the Mission. They call it the Compass, because that's the place for the homeless.
Well, I'm going to do the Holden thing, and that is bring the forum to a formal stop. People are certainly welcome to continue talking, and I would really encourage, we've heard from one another that if there's follow-up to be done, to seek each other out and to continue the learning and the sharing. So thanks to everyone who's come and who shared tonight.